145%, while the average annual wages of the bottom 90% rose by only 16%. In the U.S., while the number of strikes is relatively unchanged, the number of striking workers has beat prior years. Some 362,000 workers have gone on a strike so far in 2023, compared with 36,600 over the same period 2 years ago. Job security should be a concern for Americans. Corporate bankruptcies have soared to a 13-year high. The workers on strike, like many other Americans, complain that their wages have not kept up with inflation. The official inflation rate in the U.S. for 2023 reported to be 3%, with the pay increase to have been 5%, outstripping inflation. But that does not match what the average American is facing when it comes to things like groceries, energy, transportation, travel, and dining. Just take a look at these figures in this table, showing the types of inflation that Americans faced in 2022. Although inflation has decreased in 2023, it is not the 5% that the U.S. government has announced across the board. Perhaps that is why the U.S. is experiencing an increase in poverty, which in 2022 was 12.4%. That's an increase of 4.6 percentage points from 2021. And in terms of food assistance, another shocking figure: 41.2 million Americans, 12.5% of the total U.S. population, received monthly SNAP benefits in the 2022 fiscal year. The U.S. makes around $6.3 trillion in income, and believe it or not, spends half of that amount on entitlement programs like food assistance and benefits. This does not sound like a very healthy economy. A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affects health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe. And it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms, because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the Group of Seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting, perhaps there are some quirks in the data, that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecast predicts, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Iran has vowed a resolute response to Israel after the regime's prime minister threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Islamic Republic. Amir Saeed Iravani said Israel's threat to use nuclear weapons is a serious threat to international peace and security, and the international community must not remain indifferent or silent. The Iranian envoy urged the United Nations Security Council to denounce Israel's reckless statement. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has also denounced Israel's nuclear threat against the country. Zahra Ershadi has called on the international community to force the regime to abandon nuclear weapons, join the NPT, and accept the IAEA safeguard system.
The Israeli regime, with the support of the United States, has consistently opposed all initiatives aimed at establishing a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. The possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by this regime poses a severe threat to the security of the Middle East and beyond. A vivid example of this regime's outlawed action is calling for a so-called, I quote, credible nuclear threat against Iran, end of quote, which was brazenly raised by the regime's prime minister on 22nd September 2023.
Ershadi slammed Tel Aviv's irresponsible threat, which he said was against international norms and rules. Days earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had addressed the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, calling for a credible nuclear threat against Iran.
Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
His office soon afterwards said that Netanyahu had misspoken, and that his prepared text said credible military threat. Iran says the international community should reject and condemn any normalization of nuclear rhetoric and, in particular, the threat of use of nuclear weapons. Israel has a widely known but undeclared nuclear program. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as of January, Israel was believed to possess a stockpile of around 90 nuclear warheads. But analysts believe the regime possesses 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the Middle East's sole possessor of non-conventional arms. The Tel Aviv regime has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. On the contrary, Iran has long been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as a signatory to the NPT. Tehran has repeatedly declared that its nuclear program remains purely peaceful as always, and that the Islamic Republic had no intention of developing nuclear weapons as a matter of Islamic and state principles. Iran proved the peaceful nature of its nuclear program to the world by signing the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, with six world powers, but the United States later quit it. Ever since the Islamic Republic of Iran decided to restart its nuclear activities after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it has faced consistent threats from Western nations and their regional allies, especially Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinated its nuclear scientists. Several Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2020. Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of undeclared nuclear warheads.
What I call in English whistleblower, to inform the world about Israel's nuclear secrets, because no one speaks or no one reports exactly what's going there.
In 1986, Vanunu duped Israel's vaunted security apparatus and smuggled a camera into the secret Dimona plant. His photographs exposed the world's greatest nuclear cover-up. What he showed was that Israel's nuclear arms program was far bigger and much more powerful than anyone had even dreamt possible.
Enough material every year for 10 bombs.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities.
The U.S. President Joe Biden went on a three-day trip to Asia recently. His trip included stops in India for the G20 summit, then Vietnam to upgrade their bilateral relationship. The purpose of his trip was to enhance U.S. relationship with regional countries, especially in a G20 format. But that is just a formal way of not saying what the true intentions of the U.S. President were. For starters, Joe Biden had said that his intentions to strengthen ties with China's neighbors weren't designed to contain Beijing, a phrase that he has repeated again and again. He has said things like, "I don't want to contain China. We're not trying to hurt China. America's goal is getting the relationship right."
I am sincere about getting the relationship right. And one of the things that is going on now is China's beginning to change some of the rules of the game.
But his visit to Vietnam right after the G20 summit relayed a different message. The two countries signed a historic agreement to upgrade relations to the level of comprehensive strategic partnership. Joe Biden secured deals with Vietnam on semiconductors and minerals. So important is Vietnam for the U.S. that executives from Google, Intel, Amcor, Marvel, GlobalFoundries, and Boeing met with Vietnamese tech executives, along with the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, for more deals, with semiconductors the centerpiece of an action plan adopted during Biden's visit. So what gives? Why is Vietnam so important to the U.S.? It's pretty obvious. The U.S. wants to rival China and at the same time inflict economic damage. So much for Biden saying we're not trying to hurt China. But the U.S. has other plans for Vietnam, which was not announced yet.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program. And shortly with our guest speaker, we are talking about the dress code or some of the Islamic laws related to the dress code based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. My first question, Sheikh Jabid, is, about buying and selling women's lingerie, especially if men are put to the job. I mean, what's the ruling, what's the jurisprudential law about men buying and selling or trading in women's lingerie?
You're right. Well, according to the answer issued by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei to a similar question, there is no harm in, you know, in buying or selling women's lingerie.
Mm-hmm.
Per se, it is quite permissible. And he has stated that it is permissible provided that it does not result in any kind of evil or any kind of immorality or indecency or maybe a kind of sin. Because if a woman wears, if a man sells a woman's lingerie, and then the woman, because the clients, the men are coming, women are coming in, and they buy those things, there is a possibility of the two parties falling into a sin. If there is such a possibility, of course, it's not permissible. If there's no such possibility, and one is quite confident that he will not be led to a sin, to an immoral act, mm-hmm. then there's no problem.
I see. Well, is it permissible, Christophe, to make or buy and sell transparent clothes like stockings?
Well, there is no objection to making and trading in them, provided that they are not intended for women to wear before men, in front of men who are non-mahram to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's not the intention, there is no objection to making them, to trading them, selling them, you know, and buying them. It depends on the intention.
Mm-hmm. I see. And is it permissible, Shishovit, for unmarried men, boys actually,
yes,
to work in boutiques selling women's clothes and cosmetics, provided you know, that they abide by religious as well as ethical laws and norms?
Well, the permissibility of legitimate work and earning halal living is not confined to one group of people. It is therefore permissible for anyone to go about their business, provided that they abide by the Islamic norms and ethics and Sharia rules, of course. And, you know, sometimes maybe the authorities require special conditions for trading in certain sectors, which may have been designed to protect the public interest. And if there is such conditions, then the conditions must be complied with, because of course in an Islamic country there is an institution, there is an organization that is responsible for setting the dress code or defining the dress code and telling the people who produce mm-hmm. such things not to make or produce clothes that are, you know, morally and, you know, offensive. So if there are certain conditions announced by those authorities who are vested with authority, of course, then those conditions must be complied with.
And if they are complied with, those conditions are met.
Yeah, if people violate those conditions, it means that they are acting against Sharia law, because yes. the authorities, they try to implement the Sharia code and tell the tailors or producers or companies or firms to manufacture things which are Sharia compliant.
Mm-hmm.
And if they violate the codes, of course, they are actually going against Islamic Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
So those conditions must be complied with
mm-hmm.
by people who engage in such trade, in such in selling women's clothing.
Mm-hmm. But according to the Sharia laws, Sheikh Javid, specifically the fatwa issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, isn't it actually like canonized that, for example, sanctioned by Islamic laws,
yes.
that men, for example, would deal with and trade in men's clothes, for example, and women for women. Like, for example, when you refer to some jewelry shop, you see that there are lots of men. Involved, but they're selling the gems and
ornaments
or whatever that belongs to the women's department to the women.
Yes.
And apart from the psychological, pressure which is put on the women who are yeah, about right. to buy, for example, those gems or jewelries,
yes.
What does the Sharia law say in this regard? Like, doesn't it sanction, for example, men trading in men's, for example, stuff, and women for women?
Well, you're right to a large extent, but you know, people who run their businesses, like someone who has a jewelry shop, he is running his own business, and the business belongs to the man and not to his wife. Otherwise, I think the wife would sell and sell those things.
But we have business women, as well.
Yeah, it is very much appropriate for ladies to sell ladies' stuff.
Yes.
And for men to wear.
For example, when it comes to underwear,
you're right.
Everybody expects that the women actually sell those stuff to the women, not men.
Yeah, you're right. But even then, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini says that there's no objection as long as it does not entail any kind of evil.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a very late break now. Thank you for actually bearing us up to now. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the Sharia laws, or some of them, about the conspicuous clothes as well as the dress code, whatever, in that department, with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, what's the jurisprudential law in the matter of men wearing chains? As you can see, in today's world, lots of boys or even men, they are wearing some kind of chains in different metal, of course.
You're right.
You know, they are made of different metals. Some of them are gold, some of them silver, or the other types. So what's the religious law regarding this?
You rightly mentioned the question that you raised was very nice, because in this time around we see men or boys wearing chains, of course. There's no doubt as to the fact that if the chains are made of gold, then it is absolutely forbidden for men to wear any kind of objects that are made of gold, mm-hmm. okay, including a watch made of gold, or even a gold-plated watch, chains made of gold, or any kind of bracelets or any items. So, because it's explicitly stated in the Sharia sources that men are not allowed to wear gold items. So,
does this apply to the false teeth?
Of course, it does. It does.
Like, they are not about to wear, men cannot wear, for example, false teeth which are made of gold?
It's not permissible because, especially when it is used as when it is viewed as an ornament, mm-hmm. because there are substitutes. You can wear, something other than gold, mm-hmm. Which can still have the same function.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So there's also another thing that His Eminence has said that, if a chain is used for the exclusive use of women,
mm-hmm.
Again, it's not permissible for men to wear them.
I see. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for joining our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, all trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, take care to provide well for your future abode. Do not barter away eternal blessing for pleasures of this mortal and fleeting world. Do not talk about things which you do not know. Do not speculate about and pass verdicts on subjects about which you are not in a position to form an opinion and are not called upon to do so. Give up the way where there is a possibility of your going astray. When there is danger on your wandering in the wilderness of ignorance, possibility of losing the sight of the goal which you want to attain and of reaching the end aimed at, then it is better to give up the quest than to advance facing uncertain dangers and unforeseen risks. Advise people to do good and live virtuously because you are fit to give such advice. Let your words and deeds teach the world lessons of how to abstain from wickedness and vicious deeds. Try your best to keep away from those who indulge in vices and sins. Fight whenever required to defend the cause of Allah. When you think of defending the cause of Allah, do not be afraid that people will laugh at you, censure your action, or slander you. Fearlessly and boldly help truth and justice. Bear patiently the sufferings and face bravely the obstacles which come in your way when you follow truth and when you try to uphold it. Adhere to the cause of truth and justice wherever you find it. Try to be well versed with Islamic jurisprudence and theology and acquire a thorough knowledge of the canons of this religion.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, when we are talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence throughout his life was faced with certain individuals who we can say were ignorant. These were people who lacked ma'arifa, they lacked knowledge, they lacked wisdom, they lacked basira, acumen, and insight. It is quite unfortunate that these people that Imam Ali alayhi salam was faced with were these kind of people. People who really weren't at all a help to His Eminence. Matter of fact, it can be easily said that these people were a harm and a detriment and an obstacle to the goals and the missions that Imam Ali alayhi salam had in place. Now, what's interesting, we find Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about ignorant people, and he says that ignorant people, they have a tendency to not see their own shortcomings, and also they are not willing to take the advice that is given to them. Now, this is a very interesting characteristics and attributes that are taught to us by Imam Ali alayhi salam regarding people that are ignorant. Now, we, of course, must take a lesson from this, and this is what the miraculous aspect of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is.
And that is that even after the passage of over 1,400 some years, we find that these aspects of the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam are still very much applicable to the present day. And so we too must avoid, you know, at all costs, to be labeled as being one of the people of ignorance or the people that are ignorant. And of course, we have to refrain from these two characteristics, which Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, refrained from. But he also emphasized to the Muslims and to his followers that we too must refrain from these two characteristics and qualities. Of course, the first one was the idea that we do not accept our shortcomings. Every single one of us has shortcomings, and we must be aware that we have shortcomings. And of course, we must work towards fixing these shortcomings of ours. And the second is to accept advice which is given to us via pious, honorable, and noble people. Taking that advice, trying to implement that advice, and hopefully reforming ourselves for the better is going to be, of course, of benefit to us, and it is something that is necessary for us to do. A very beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
We are on two sides. Either you love Ali ibn Abi Talib or you hate Ali ibn Abi Talib. That's if you know Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that is why we find a hadith from our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. أَنَّهُ قَالْ لِعَلِيٍ يَا عَلِي لَا يُحِبُّكَ إِلَّا مُؤْمِنٍ وَلَا يُبْغِذُكَ إِلَّا مُنَافِقٍ He says, oh Ali, no. That those who love you, that is a sign of iman. Yeah? And for those who hate you, that is a sign of nifaq, hypocrisy in their hearts. Now, we need to look, before we describe what is it about Imam Ali alayhi salam that makes him loved and hated at the same time so much, we need to have an introduction to understand this whole idea or this concept of this jazibiyah, as it is known in Arabic, this attraction. Specifically in matters of personal relationships. For example, the first time I meet somebody, there could be something within you which attracts me to you. First time, I don't even know you. Yeah, but there is something you have. Maybe it is your akhlaq. Maybe it is the way you dress. Maybe it is something which attracts me to you and wants me. And there's a desire within me to become your friend. Now parents use this all the time, don't they? When they see a child, their child bring a friend home, right away they'll say no. I don't accept this friend or I accept this friend. Either by the way they look, by the way they dress, by the way they conduct themselves. You know, the way we present ourselves has a major impact on the way other people will look at us. This is natural. I remember, well, in university, My brother had this consulting job, and they would go into universities and they would have job fairs, right? And people who are graduating would come and apply. And they said as he would be sitting there, people would come to apply, they would accept everybody's application. But as soon as they would come, they would put a number 1, 2, and 3 based entirely on how you look. If you're given a number 3, that means there's no way you're getting an interview because you don't meet the role of the company. Yeah, that means earrings, you have a funny looking haircut, whatever it is. If you don't meet the needs of that company, and if you'd be somebody who would embarrass that company, they don't want you in that company. So this is a major role they play.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
A new survey has shown that employment in Germany has dropped for the first time in 3 years. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg, citing the German Info Institute for Economic Research, wrote, "Hiring in Germany has stalled amid a worsening economic environment as the country continues to struggle with an energy crisis and soaring borrowing costs." A measure reflecting hiring activity dropped to its lowest level since February 2021 this month, as employers in manufacturing and construction are thinking twice before taking on new staff, the study revealed. The robust expansion of employment seen over the past few months has come to a standstill, said Klaus Warup, head of surveys at Info, adding, due to a lack of orders, companies are being rather cautious about filling vacant positions. Economists say that the German labor market is showing the first cracks in what had been until now a very resilient environment and is now losing steam as overall economic activity weakens. Unemployment is expected to further increase until the economy recovers, experts warn. Experts said companies' willingness to hire new staff will presumably rise again once the economy recovers. In the medium term, demographic change will deprive the labor market of more and more workers. Hirings in the EU's largest economy dropped for the first time in nearly 3 years, a separate survey of purchasing managers showed recently. This comes as businesses and industry are increasingly pessimistic regarding Germany's economic outlook amid weaker external demand and a lack of orders, as well as shortages of qualified workers and tighter monetary policy. Germany's economy officially slipped into a technical recession in the first quarter of the year after contracting by 0.3%. Its GDP is expected to shrink by another 0.5% by the year's end. RT noted the struggling German economy could once again be called the sick man of Europe if structural issues are not addressed immediately. Deutsche Bank CEO Christian Suing has warned European countries are often given this label when they experience economic difficulties, social unrest, or impoverishment. Germany received this notorious status in late 1990s and was described this way into early 2000. Suing said in his address at Handelsblatt Banken Summit 2023 recently, "We are not the sick man of Europe, but it is also true that there are structural weaknesses that hold back our economy and prevent it from developing its great potential. We will become the sick man of Europe if we do not address these structural issues now." He added, identifying the issues as high and unpredictable energy costs, slow internet connections, outdated rail networks, digitalization backlogs, a lack of skilled workers, excessive bureaucracy and long approval procedures. The EU's largest economy continues to grapple with challenges in its manufacturing sector, as it suffers from higher energy costs. It officially slipped into a technical recession in the first quarter of the year as GDP growth was revised from 0% to -0.3%. The Bundesbank announced recently that the economy was likely to shrink this quarter thanks to slow private consumption and the increasing weakness of the industry. The Deutsche Bank chief executive said, "We must not deceive ourselves. We are still lagging behind our international competitors. Even if the special economic situation caused by interest rates currently glosses over this somewhat, more for some institutions, less for others." According to him, European economies should avoid becoming too dependent on non-European banks. The biggest task lies with banks, whose roles are changing as a result of the global shifts, Suing noted. The banker suggested, "In Europe, we need a framework that gives banks more leeway to lend, facilitates capital market financing, and enables Europe-wide growth." Germany's crucial construction sector has been on the brink of collapse, putting in jeopardy the overall economy. The Economist reported that recently, citing housing giant Vonovia. The report says the sector makes up 12% of the country's GDP and employs 1 million construction workers. The chief executive of Vonovia, Ralf Busch, was quoted as saying, "We are sending our construction industry into the abyss." The article indicated that despite the German government's pledge to build 400,000 flats a year, industry estimates have shown that about 700,000 a year are needed, not least to house the more than 1 million Ukrainians taking shelter in the country. Last year, just 295,000 new buildings were built. Busch described the resulting shortage of affordable housing in parts of the country as a societal tinderbox. The Economists wrote that soaring energy prices and high building material costs as a result of supply chain disruptions have been crippling the construction industry. Meanwhile, higher interest rates have increased the cost of debt that many German builders rely on to get projects off the ground, it noted. All of this has resulted in construction firms and property developers going bust, with 437 building companies filing for insolvency in the first 4 months of this year, representing an increase of 20% year-on-year. It is not a functioning market, head of think tank Info Clemens Fuchs said, pointing to remorseless red tape, namely the introduction of rent break as well as strict environmental regulations. The German Property Federation, ZIA, said in its spring report that housing shortages have likely reached their highest level in 20 years and that the gap between supply and demand may widen to 700,000 buildings by 2025. According to ZIA estimates, 1.4 million people will be looking for a place to live in 2024 and will not be able to find one if they don't turn things around immediately.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyah.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholar life of the most outstanding companions or Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad and the Shiite infallible Imams. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sayyid Naghwi, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having us.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most important Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam and Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, by the name of Amr ibn Hamq Khuzai, mainly known as Al-Khuzai. So he was martyred by Muawiyah, and he is considered among the important narrators of Hadith al-Qadir. Before getting to his religious and scholar life, his support for the Ahlul Bayt, especially Imam Ali alayhi salam, let's be more familiar with his early life. Shaykh Rouhani, what information do you have about him?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Amr ibn Hamq Khuzai died in the 50 year of Hijrah. He was among the companions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, as well as Amirul Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wa salam, and the second Imam, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wa salam. Of course, he also participated in many of the battles like Jamal and Siffin and Nahrawan, and protected Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam against the attacks of Muawiyah and the other enemies of him. So he finally, as you rightly mentioned, was martyred by Muawiyah, and he was the first shaheed and martyr whose head was actually taken from a city to the city, be shown to the people by the by Muawiyah.
Yes.
And yes, of course, the other thing that we can say, he was one of the great ashab or the companions of the Holy Prophet as well, as he converted to Islam and Sulh Hudaybiyah, or the Hudaybiyah peace, agreement that was signed by the Prophet and the other, let's say, tribes. So, of course, the other point about him is that he was exiled to Sham and then Kufa. He was one of the great narrators of the riwayat and ahadith of Ahlul Bayt.